A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. We talked about the rather depressing state of the rental market in Israel in a recent episode that I created on the website for anyone who wants to check out mywordprompts.com. There's a playlist called Daniel's Picks, and it's actually available now as well as an XML feed. So if you want to subscribe just to my picks instead of the main episode feed, it's there, and it consists of basically all the episodes that I've really enjoyed and thought, this was great, this is something that someone else should listen to. Not that I don't love all our episodes, but some are true treasures. And that was a real tour de force for anyone who wants to begin to think critically about, the rental situation being broken in Israel is one thing, but what can we actually do is another. And I mentioned, I think yesterday, that I was tuning into one of the UK radio stations on TuneIn Radio, for no particular reason other than to listen to some music. And I was just tuned in, and then the ad came on the air announcing a new citizens' rights site that the UK government has set up in order to basically try to clamp down on some of the pathetic practices that we mentioned are completely prevalent in Israel, including the ridiculous situation by which renters not only have the privilege of paying for rent, paying someone else's mortgage, zero protections against arbitrary evictions or tenancy conclusions, often really debating a fine line there, and also have to pay a realtor's fee that was supposed to be illegal for the privilege of finding a place, and the landlord pays nothing. It's a completely dysfunctional, broken market and a total failure of the legislature that attempted to bring in laws that were just ineffective. It was a bit grim. But we're looking at some places on the internet, and there's a funny / tragic Facebook group in Hebrew called Departments in Israel That Depress Me. I'm translating the name from Hebrew. And it consists of people, disaffected Israelis about my own age, or probably a lot younger at this point, who find the most outrageous and shambolic listings on Facebook groups in Yad Shtayim, which is a national apartment hunting site, and post them maybe as a form of social retribution, but I think it's more because it's such a bad situation, it's better to collectively laugh at it sometimes. And I've seen on that website some of the most ridiculous things. My favorite one was a toilet that was positioned. There was like an overhang on top of, this was a studio, there was an overhang from the top floor, which was essentially a bunk bed, and the landlord had put the toilet in this kind of protrusion that literally hung about 1 foot on top of the fridge. And the title was something like, "Who wants to rent a place where you can do your business above where you eat?" or something like that. One of the best ones. But there's a few gems in that group for those who want to laugh and or cry at the same time about the rental situation. I have a specific question today because one of the listings that we saw today was a place with no windows. And I don't know off the top of my head if that's illegal. I suspect it is, according to some law. Hannah is nodding in agreement. She says it definitely is. Hannah is an architect, as we mention often. But whether it's illegal or not, I think the takeaway from the rental situation in Israel is that if nobody enforces the law, the law is just kind of toilet paper, essentially. I'd love to ask Herman and Corin about natural light in apartments, because this is one of those human ergonomics things that it's so easy to, I mean, it's an extreme case to have an apartment without natural light or without windows, but there's some places where they might adhere to the law technically, but there's essentially almost no light. We've talked about vitamin D before, which is, often, I feel like it's, after that episode, super interesting topic. It sounds like vitamin C. It's so much more powerful. It's essential for our well-being. But even if you're just indoors, you have to get some natural light exposure. And I'd love to learn about a bit more about how important natural light is to our sense of well-being. We did an episode about SAD before, seasonal affective disorder. And that's not something I can say I've really ever experienced, although I have a good friend here who does have it. And really, you can see in his mood when the nights get dark, it really affects him. But I do recall once working for a summer in a building that was, whatever way the office was positioned, this was kind of a co-working space. My first year in college, that there was almost no natural light at all. There were no windows, and it was kind of in the middle of a big long hallway, and there was just illumination, basically like artificial illumination. And I do recall distinctly feeling kind of just glum for no particular reason, especially towards the end of a week. And then you'd kind of like walk out to get some groceries and you'd feel alive again. And it kind of hit us that, wait, is this office actually making us depressed? So it's a real thing. And I'd love to know how real it is, even if we're talking about people who don't have any pre-existing mental health problems or depression or seasonal affective disorder. We often hear that bright, airy spaces are good. I guess my question is there kind of like some diminishing returns, or should we probably be throwing open our curtains and getting as much natural light as we can into our spaces? Herman and Corin, let's talk about the ergonomics of light, its role with our circadian rhythm, as we've talked about. And today, let's talk about how it actually affects our mood and whether you should be looking for a big, bright window in the next rental or place you live.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been deep in the Israeli rental market trenches, scrolling through a Facebook group called, roughly translated, Apartments in Israel That Depress Me. And honestly, the name alone is a whole thesis statement about the state of things.
It really is. And the prompt zeroes in on something specific that came out of that doom scrolling, a listing with no windows, zero natural light, which raises the question, is that even legal? Short answer, yes, it's illegal under Israeli building code. But as the prompt rightly notes, a law without enforcement is just decorative paper. The real question is what living without natural light actually does to a person.
And it's not just about the extreme case of a windowless concrete box. It's about the slow drip of living in a place where you technically have a window, but it faces a wall 3 feet away, or it's the size of a pizza box, or the building across the alley blocks everything. The prompt mentions working in a windowless office during college and feeling glum by the end of the week, not depressed in a clinical sense, just... and then stepping outside and feeling alive again. That's the thing worth unpacking.
And it's one of those areas where the science is actually quite robust, but the public understanding lags behind. We've talked about vitamin D before, we've touched on seasonal affective disorder, but the prompt is asking something more fundamental. Even if you're a perfectly healthy person with no history of depression, does natural light exposure matter for your mood and well-being? And the answer is an emphatic yes. It's not just about vitamin D synthesis. It's about a whole cascade of neurobiological processes that are directly triggered by light hitting your retina.
Let's do the thing. Walk me through what happens when sunlight enters the eye. What's the chain reaction?
Okay, so the key player here is a photoreceptor called melanopsin, which was only discovered in the late 1990s. Before that, we thought the eye basically had two types of photoreceptors: rods for low light, cones for color and detail. But there's a third class, these intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, or IPRGCs, that contain melanopsin, and they don't contribute to vision in the way we normally think about it. They're sending signals directly to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, that's the brain's master clock, and to a whole range of other regions including the amygdala and the hypothalamus, which regulate mood and stress responses.
There's literally a dedicated biological pathway that exists for no other reason than to register ambient light and tune your entire nervous system accordingly.
And here's the thing. These melanopsin-containing cells are most sensitive to blue light at around 480 nanometers. That's the wavelength abundant in morning daylight. When that light hits your retina, it suppresses melatonin, raises cortisol in a healthy way, the get-up-and-go hormone, and sets your circadian rhythm for the day. But it also directly influences serotonin production and release. The pathway goes from those retinal cells to the dorsal raphe nucleus, a major serotonin-producing center in the brainstem.
The mechanism is direct. It's not metaphorical. Light enters eye, signal travels to brain region adjusts serotonin output. That's about as mechanical as biology gets.
It really is. and there was a really elegant study published by researchers at the University of Liège in Belgium. They put people in functional MRI scanners and exposed them to different light conditions. Blue-enriched light, which mimics morning daylight, produced a much stronger activation in the amygdala and the hypothalamus compared to green light of the same intensity, and the effects were measurable within minutes. We're not talking about something that takes weeks to build up. This is a near-immediate neurobiological response.
That explains the office experience. You're in a fluorescent-lit box all day. Your melanopsin system is essentially understimulated. Your brain's mood centers are running on low power. And then you step outside and suddenly everything lights up, literally and figuratively.
And fluorescent lighting is particularly bad at this. Standard cool white fluorescent tubes have a spectral power distribution that's very spiky. They have peaks in certain wavelengths, but they don't produce the broad, continuous spectrum that daylight does. And critically, the intensity is far lower. Even a brightly lit office might be around 500 lux at desk level. Overcast daylight outside is 10,000 lux. Direct sunlight is 100,000 lux. The difference is orders of magnitude.
The indoor environment is essentially a sensory deprivation chamber for this particular biological system. We've evolved over millions of years to expect massive daily doses of bright, full-spectrum light, and then in the last 100 years, we've moved into caves lit by flickering tubes.
Here's where the Israeli rental context makes this even more pointed. The prompt mentions vitamin D, and we've discussed that before, but the light-mood connection is actually separate from vitamin D synthesis. Vitamin D is produced in the skin from UVB radiation, which does not pass through glass. So sitting by a sunny window does nothing for your vitamin D levels. But it absolutely does everything for your melanopsin system because blue light passes through glass just fine. So even if you're not going outside, having a large window with a view of the sky is providing a genuine neurobiological benefit that has nothing to do with vitamin D.
That's a useful distinction. So the person in the windowless apartment is getting a double hit. No vitamin D synthesis from sun on skin, and no melanopsin activation from skylight entering the eye. Two different systems, both starved.
We haven't even touched on the psychological dimension yet, which is also real and also studied. There's a concept in environmental psychology called prospect and refuge, the idea that humans find spaces comforting when they can see out into the world while feeling safely enclosed. A window provides prospect. It gives you information about the weather, the time of day, the season. Take that away entirely and you're in what researchers call a sensory-deprived living environment. Studies in hospital settings have shown that patients in rooms with a view of nature recover faster and require less pain medication than patients in rooms facing a brick wall. That was a landmark study by Roger Ulrich in 1984, and it's been replicated many times since.
The hospital study is striking because it controls for everything else. Same medical care, same building, same staff. The only variable is what's outside the window, and it measurably affects physical recovery. That's not woo-woo wellness talk. That's hard data.
The effect sizes are not trivial. Ulrich's original study found that patients with a nature view had shorter post-operative stays, took fewer potent analgesics, and had fewer negative evaluative comments in nurses' notes. More recent work has extended this to office environments. A study by the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology found that employees in offices with optimized daylight exposure reported significantly lower perceived stress and higher overall well-being compared to those in artificially lit spaces. And objective measures backed this up. Cortisol levels were lower, sleep quality was better.
Let me push on the diminishing returns part of the prompt. Is there a point where more natural light stops helping? If you've got a floor-to-ceiling window with direct sun all day, are you still getting marginal benefits, or does it plateau?
There absolutely are diminishing returns. And in fact, there are downsides to excessive direct sunlight in living spaces. Glare causes eye strain, makes screens unusable, and creates thermal discomfort. There's also the issue of circadian disruption if you're getting bright light at the wrong time of day. The melanopsin system is most sensitive in the morning. That's when bright light is beneficial for setting your circadian rhythm. But bright light late in the evening, particularly blue-enriched light, can delay melatonin release and push your sleep phase later. So it's not just about quantity, it's about timing and quality.
The ideal isn't maximum light at all times. It's bright morning light, moderate afternoon light, and dimming into warm spectrum light in the evening. The body expects a narrative arc of illumination across the day.
That's beautifully put. The body expects a story, not a constant, and this is where a lot of modern lighting design goes wrong. We've optimized for task performance, bright, uniform illumination that lets you read and work at any hour, but we've ignored the biological signaling function of light entirely. The WEL building standard, one of the leading certification systems for healthy buildings, actually has specific requirements for circadian lighting design. They require at least 200 equivalent melanopic lux at eye level for at least 4 hours during the day in regularly occupied spaces. That's a metric specifically designed around the melanopsin sensitivity curve, not just visual brightness.
200 melanopic lux for 4 hours. That's a concrete number. How does a typical Israeli apartment stack up?
It depends enormously on the apartment, but a space that meets the legal minimum for windows in Israel, often a small window in one room, is not going to hit that target unless you're sitting right next to the glass. Israeli building code requires that every habitable room have a window with a glazed area of at least 8% of the floor area. So for a 12 square meter bedroom, that's a window just under 1 square meter. That's not nothing, but if the window faces a light well or is shaded by a neighboring building, you might be getting a fraction of the daylight that hits the exterior. And the legal minimum is often exactly what you get in budget apartments.
The prompt's point about enforcement is key here. A landlord can put in a window that technically meets code. It's the right size, it opens. But if it faces a concrete wall 18 inches away, you're getting effectively zero daylight. The law is satisfied on paper and violated in spirit.
This is exactly the dynamic that the Facebook group The Prompt mentions. Apartments in Israel that depress me exist to document. These are spaces that are technically legal but practically absurd. The toilet hanging over the fridge is the same category of problem. It's legal in the sense that nobody stopped it, but it represents a complete failure of the regulatory system to ensure basic human dignity in rental housing.
Let's talk about the enforcement failure specifically, because it connects to the larger theme from the earlier rental episodes. Israel actually passed a law several years ago making it illegal for landlords to charge tenants a broker's fee. The law says the party who hires the broker pays, but in practice, the market has completely ignored this. Landlords list apartments through brokers. Tenants pay the fee because if they refuse, someone else will take the place. The law exists and is functionally meaningless.
Right, and the window situation is the same thing, but with health consequences instead of financial ones. The law says every habitable room needs a window of a certain size. But if nobody from the municipality is inspecting rental properties and tenants are desperate enough to accept anything, the law accomplishes nothing. And the health consequences are not trivial. We're talking about measurable effects on sleep quality, mood, cognitive performance, and even immune function.
The immune function connection is one I hadn't heard before. What's the mechanism there?
It's largely mediated through the circadian system. Your immune response is strongly circadian. The production and activity of various immune cells follows a daily rhythm. Natural killer cells, which are important for fighting viral infections and cancer surveillance, peak during the day. Inflammatory cytokines have their own rhythms. When you disrupt the circadian system through inadequate light exposure during the day and excessive light exposure at night, you dysregulate these immune rhythms. There's good evidence from shift workers that circadian disruption increases susceptibility to infection and chronic inflammatory conditions. And shift workers are essentially an extreme case of what happens when you decouple light exposure from the natural day-night cycle.
The windowless apartment isn't just making you feel glum. It's potentially making you more susceptible to getting sick, and you might not connect the dots because the mechanism is invisible and delayed.
And this is the kind of thing that's very hard to capture in public health statistics, because nobody's recording lived in a light-deprived apartment as a risk factor. But the biological plausibility is strong, and the experimental evidence in controlled settings is consistent.
Let me bring this back to the practical question in the prompt. Someone is looking for their next rental. They've internalized that natural light matters. What should they actually look for? What's the checklist?
First thing, orientation. In the northern hemisphere, south-facing windows get the most direct sunlight throughout the day. In Israel, that's actually quite intense and can lead to overheating in summer, so east or west-facing might be preferable depending on your schedule. East-facing gets bright morning light, which is ideal for circadian entrainment. West-facing gets strong afternoon and evening light, which can be lovely but also hot. North-facing gets the least direct light. It's cooler and more consistent, but you'll get less total illumination.
What about window size relative to room size? Is there a rule of thumb?
The building code standard of 8% of floor area is a minimum, not an optimum. For good daylighting, architects typically aim for 15 to 20%. But the raw percentage doesn't tell you everything. You also need to consider the visible sky component. That's the amount of sky visible from a given point in the room. If your window faces another building 5 meters away, the visible sky might be near zero even if the window is large. What you want is a view of the sky, not just a view of the neighbor's wall.
The practical advice is, visit the apartment at different times of day. See what the light actually does. Don't trust photos. Real estate photos are notoriously manipulated with wide-angle lenses and HDR processing that makes every space look like it's bathed in golden hour light.
And specifically, visit in the morning if you can. If the apartment is dim at 10 in the morning on a clear day, it's going to be dim all the time. Also pay attention to what's outside the window. A tree that provides pleasant, dappled shade is very different from a concrete wall. And check whether the windows are obstructed by external elements. Security bars, shutters that don't fully retract, adjacent buildings.
The security bar thing is interesting in the Israeli context. A lot of apartments have them, and they can significantly reduce light transmission. It's a trade-off between safety and light.
It's not just the bars themselves. Many Israeli apartments have what's called a safe room, or mamada, a reinforced concrete room with a heavy steel window and blast door. These rooms are mandatory in new construction since the 1990s. The window in a mamad is designed for protection, not for light. It's small, often covered with a heavy steel plate that swings open, and the glass is thick and tinted. If your only bedroom is a mamad, your light exposure in that room is going to be severely limited.
Which connects to something I saw in the news recently. There was a report in the Jerusalem Post about how safe rooms are affecting the rental market. Apartments with mamads command significantly higher rents because of the security factor. But people are paying more for spaces that are, in terms of natural light, objectively worse than older apartments with large unprotected windows.
That tension between safety and livability is a genuine dilemma, and it's not one that most tenants are weighing consciously. The security benefit is obvious and emotionally salient. The light deficit is subtle and cumulative. You don't notice it on the day you sign the lease. You notice it 3 months later when you realize you've been feeling inexplicably low energy and you're not sleeping well.
Let's talk about what you can do if you're already in a light-deprived space and moving isn't an option. Are there technological interventions that actually work?
Yes, and the most evidence-based one is a light therapy lamp. These produce 10,000 lux of broad-spectrum light at a specified distance, typically used for 30 minutes in the morning. They were developed primarily for seasonal affective disorder, but the research shows they're effective for non-seasonal mood disturbances as well, particularly when the underlying issue is insufficient light exposure. The key specifications, 10,000 lux at a comfortable sitting distance, UV filtered, and a color temperature of around 5,000 to 6,500 Kelvin, which mimics midday daylight. And these are not absurdly expensive anymore. You can get a clinically specced lamp for under $100.
What about the simple stuff? Take your morning coffee outside. Eat lunch on a bench. The prompt mentions stepping out for groceries and feeling alive again. That's essentially a low-tech light therapy session.
It's the most effective intervention of all, and it costs nothing. 15 to 30 minutes of outdoor light exposure in the morning, even on an overcast day, provides orders of magnitude more light than any indoor environment. Sitting in shade outdoors gives you 5,000 to 10,000 lux of ambient light, 10 to 20 times what you'd get in a well-lit office. The recommendation from chronobiologists is to get at least 30 minutes of outdoor light before noon. That simple habit has been shown to improve sleep quality, mood, and cognitive performance.
We've got a spectrum of interventions from go outside in the morning to buy a 10,000 lux lamp. But the structural problem remains. People who can least afford to move are often stuck in the worst lit apartments. And they're the same people who may not have the money for light therapy lamps or smart bulbs.
That's the equity dimension, and it's not trivial. Poor quality housing isn't just about aesthetics or comfort. It's a health issue. And the Israeli rental market, as we've discussed, puts tenants in an extraordinarily weak position. When you're competing with dozens of other applicants for every apartment, you take what you can get. If the only place you can afford has one tiny north-facing window, you take it and you tell yourself it's fine. And maybe you don't even notice the effect on your mood because it's gradual.
The prompt mentioned a UK government initiative, a citizens' rights site designed to help renters understand and enforce their rights. That's an interesting model. The UK has had a much more robust regulatory framework for rentals for a long time. Deposits must be held in government-backed schemes. Landlords must provide an energy performance certificate. There are minimum standards for habitability that are actually enforced. Israel has laws on the books, but no functional enforcement mechanism.
This gets to the heart of what makes the Israeli rental market so dysfunctional. It's not that the laws don't exist. The broker fee law exists. The window requirement exists. Minimum habitability standards exist. But enforcement is complaint-driven, and the complaint mechanisms are weak, slow, and intimidating for tenants who fear retaliation. A landlord can simply choose not to renew a lease if a tenant complains. There's no effective protection against that kind of soft retaliation.
Which means the market is self-reinforcing in the wrong direction. Bad actors face no consequences, so bad practices proliferate. Good landlords who maintain their properties and respect tenant rights are competing on an uneven playing field. And tenants learn that complaining is counterproductive, so violations go unreported. So the official statistics show no problem. So there's no political pressure to improve enforcement.
That's exactly the dynamic. And it's why the kind of social media documentation that the Facebook group represents, public shaming of the most egregious listings, is actually a form of grassroots enforcement. It doesn't have legal force, but it creates reputational costs. The problem is that most bad landlords don't have reputations to protect. They're individuals with a single property or a small portfolio, and there's always another desperate tenant.
Let me pull on a thread from earlier that we haven't fully explored. You mentioned that the Melanopsin system is separate from the visual system. That has an interesting implication. You could have perfectly adequate vision. You can see fine in your apartment. But your non-visual photoreception system is still starved. Your conscious experience is, I can see it's bright enough, but your brain's mood centers are registering a deficit.
This is a crucial point that the lighting industry has been slow to internalize. Traditional lighting metrics, lux, foot candles, color rendering index, are all based on the photopic visual system, which is dominated by cones. They tell you how well you can see. They don't tell you anything about how well the light is stimulating your melanopsin system. That's why you need a separate metric, melanopic lux or equivalent melanopic lux, to characterize the biological effect of light. And most buildings, even new ones, are not designed with this metric in mind.
We're essentially flying blind, measuring the wrong thing, and then wondering why people feel terrible in spaces that meet all the technical specifications.
Flying blind is the perfect phrase for it, and the research community has been sounding this alarm for at least 15 years. The discovery of melanopsin and the IPRGCs was a paradigm shift in our understanding of how light affects human physiology. But paradigm shifts take a long time to filter into building codes and industry practice. The WL standard I mentioned earlier is a step in the right direction, but it's voluntary and primarily adopted in high-end commercial and institutional buildings. It's not reaching the residential rental market, and it's certainly not reaching the budget end of that market.
Let's bring Hannah's architectural perspective into this. Since the prompt mentions, she confirmed that windowless rooms are illegal. Architects think about daylighting as a fundamental design parameter, not an afterthought. In Israeli architecture specifically, are there particular challenges or patterns?
Israeli architecture has some distinctive features that affect daylighting. The climate means you're always balancing light against heat. Large windows let in light, but also solar gain, which in the Israeli summer is intense. So you see a lot of buildings with deep balconies, external shading devices, and relatively small window openings compared to, say, Northern European architecture, where you want to maximize solar gain. The traditional Jerusalem stone buildings have relatively small, deep-set windows for exactly this reason. They keep the interior cool. But the consequence is that interior light levels can be quite low, especially on lower floors.
Modern Israeli apartments often have those English courtyards, light wells that technically provide a window, but with almost no direct sky view and minimal actual light. They exist to satisfy the legal requirement on paper.
The light well is the architectural embodiment of malicious compliance. It's a window, technically. It opens to the outside, technically. But the outside is a narrow shaft surrounded by walls on all sides. And the only light that reaches the bottom is whatever bounces down from the opening at the top. It's the architectural equivalent of the toilet over the fridge. It satisfies the letter of the requirement while completely defeating its purpose.
Nobody's measuring the lux levels at the bottom of that shaft. The building inspector checks that the window exists and is the right size, and that's the end of it.
And even if you wanted to measure it, there's no standard for minimum daylight levels in Israeli residential code, the way there is for, say, schools or workplaces. The requirement is geometric, window size relative to room size, not performance-based. It doesn't say the room must receive X lux of daylight at noon on the equinox. It says the window must be at least 8% of the floor area. Those are very different things.
What would a performance-based standard look like? And is there any jurisdiction that's actually implemented one?
Several European countries have moved toward performance-based daylight standards. In the Netherlands, for example, the building code requires that new residential buildings achieve a minimum daylight factor, the ratio of indoor illuminance to outdoor illuminance under overcast sky conditions in habitable rooms. The specific requirement varies by room type, but is typically around 0.5 to 1%. That doesn't sound like much, but it means that on an overcast day when it's 10,000 lux outside, the room gets 50 to 100 lux of natural light. That's a measurable, enforceable standard. And if you're at the bottom of a light well, your daylight factor is essentially zero. You'd fail the performance test even though you passed the geometric one.
Which is odd, because the physical quality is what you actually live in every day. A bad broker fee is a one-time cost. A dark apartment is a daily drain on your well-being for the entire duration of your lease.
Leases in Israel tend to be long, typically 1 year minimum, often renewed for multiple years, so the cumulative exposure to a poor light environment can be very significant. If you spend 2 years in an apartment with inadequate daylight, that's 2 years of suboptimal circadian entrainment, 2 years of suppressed mood, 2 years of potentially impaired immune function. The effects compound.
Let's talk about the flip side for a moment. Are there people who actually prefer dim spaces? The prompt asks about individual variation, and I think it's worth acknowledging that not everyone wants a sun-drenched loft. Some people find bright light overstimulating, or just prefer a cozier, darker aesthetic.
And individual differences in light sensitivity are real and understudied. Some people are simply more sensitive to light. They get headaches in bright conditions, their circadian systems may be more responsive to lower light levels. There are also cultural differences in light preferences. Northern European cultures tend to favor bright, evenly lit interiors, while Southern European and Middle Eastern cultures often prefer darker, cooler interiors as a respite from the intense outdoor light. That's a perfectly valid adaptation to climate.
The goal isn't to impose a single standard of bright is always better. It's to ensure that people have access to natural light and can modulate it according to their preferences. You can always close curtains or add shading. You can't create daylight where none exists.
That's the asymmetry. A bright apartment can be made dim. A dim apartment cannot be made bright, not really. Artificial lighting can make it adequately bright for vision, but as we've discussed, the biological signaling is different. A 10,000 lux lamp pointed at your face for 30 minutes is an intervention, not an environment. You can't live your whole day in front of a light therapy lamp.
The aesthetic dimension matters too. The prompt mentions bright, airy spaces as something we're told is good. There's a reason that real estate listings always emphasize lots of natural light and sun-drenched and bright and airy. These are universally positive descriptors in housing markets around the world. Nobody advertises a delightfully dim cave.
The exception being home theaters and bedrooms, where light control is actually a feature. But even there, the feature is the ability to make it dark when you want it dark, not the permanent absence of light. The ideal is control, the ability to have bright natural light during the day and complete darkness at night. Both ends of the cycle matter.
Let's circle back to the prompt's core question, because I think we've built a solid case. Should you be prioritizing natural light in your next rental? The answer seems to be yes, and not just as a nice to have. It's a genuine health consideration, on par with checking for damp or making sure the plumbing works. But renters often treat it as a luxury, something you'd love to have but can't really insist on. Is that a mistake?
I think it is a mistake, and I think the evidence supports treating daylight access as a fundamental habitability requirement, not an amenity. The challenge is that in a tight rental market, you're always making trade-offs. Location versus size versus price versus condition. Natural light often gets sacrificed because the effects are subtle and delayed. You don't feel the consequences on the day you sign the lease. But the research is clear. Over time, inadequate daylight exposure degrades sleep, mood, and health in measurable ways.
If you're apartment hunting, the practical advice is make natural light a non-negotiable. Visit at multiple times of day, check what the windows actually face, and don't be fooled by wide-angle photos. And if you're already in a dim space, get outside in the morning, consider a light therapy lamp, and look into circadian lighting. Is that the summary?
That's the summary. And I'd add one more thing. If you're in a place that's technically illegal, no windows at all, or windows that don't open, document it, report it, and know that you have legal recourse even if the enforcement system is weak. The more these violations are documented, the harder they are to ignore.
The documentation point connects to the Facebook group the prompt mentioned. It's a form of collective documentation. Each absurd listing that gets posted is a data point. It's not going to change policy by itself, but it builds a public record of what the market actually looks like, as opposed to what the law says it should look like.
That public record matters. Policy change often follows public awareness. The more visible these problems become, the harder it is for regulators to claim that everything is fine. The UK Citizens' Rights Campaign, the prompt mentioned, probably emerged from years of tenant advocacy and documentation of abuses. These things don't happen spontaneously.
All right, I think we've covered the science, the practical advice, and the systemic context. Let's wrap with the forward-looking question. What would it take for natural light to be treated as a genuine habitability requirement in rental markets, rather than a luxury feature?
It would take three things. First, performance-based standards in building codes. Moving from the window must be X size to the room must receive Y lux of daylight. Second, proactive enforcement, municipal inspections that don't depend on tenant complaints. And third, tenant education, making sure renters know that light isn't just about aesthetics, it's about health, and they have a right to it. None of these are technically difficult. They're politically difficult because they impose costs on landlords and developers who are well-organized and politically influential. But the health case is strong, and the evidence base is only getting stronger.
The answer to, should I prioritize natural light, is yes. And the answer to, will the market help you get it, is no. Which means you have to advocate for yourself, document violations, and make it a priority in your own housing decisions. Not the most uplifting conclusion, but an honest one.
Sometimes the most valuable thing we can do is give people the information they need to make better decisions in a broken system. The system won't fix itself overnight, but knowing that natural light isn't just a preference, it's a biological requirement, changes how you evaluate a space. And that knowledge, applied across enough renters over enough time, shifts the market.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, researchers at the University of Tasmania discovered that mantis shrimp can perceive circularly polarized light, a visual capability no other animal was known to possess. The unintended consequence? Their extreme visual complexity made them nearly impossible to study with standard optical equipment of the era, delaying research on their behavior by decades.
Right. This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the ship running. If you enjoyed this episode, head over to myweirdprompts.com where you can find the full archive and subscribe to the feed.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, a stay curious, keep weird in mind.